Welcome to this third episode of the BSH Lymphoma podcast. My name is Bernard Mabry. I'm one of the Birmingham-based specialist trainees, and it's my pleasure to welcome Shirley Desar from UCH and Queen Square to talk about the management of Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia and the associated complications. Welcome, Shirley. So,
thank you, Bernard.
So without further ado, we'll crack on to the first case. So this is a 54-year-old woman who was first diagnosed with Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia 3 years prior to presentation. And at that time, she was treated with bendamustine and rituximab. She achieved complete response, but was lost to follow-up. And now we present with fatigue, epistaxis, and blurred vision. Initial bloods showed a hemoglobin of 69 and an IgM paraprotein of 48 grams per liter. Shirley, could you just walk us through your initial approach to this case?
Yes, sure. So I think the first notable thing is the relative youth of the patient, because people generally think of Waldenstrom's as being a disease of elderly white men. But it's a lot more varied than that, actually. So she's a youngish woman, and therefore, apart from treating the disease problems that are acutely occurring, we need to think longer term as to how we keep her in a long-term remission. So she was diagnosed 3 years ago and treated with BR at the beginning. She obviously achieved a good response, but now has lost that response, one presumes, presenting with fatigue, epistaxis, and blurred vision, very anemic and very high paraprotein. So the first thing I would consider in a case like this is that, you know, there are acute problems here that she's dealing with, we have to deal with, which is basically that she's quite likely to have high viscosity from her raised IgM. She's also significantly anemic, which could be due to bone marrow involvement or indeed bleeding in addition if she's bled heavily. So in order to try and correct these factors, I think I would be very strongly considering plasma exchange for her as a sort of an emergency measure, because that'll enable us to thin her blood and give her a transfusion. So that is an early thing to consider. I would also want to know her clotting, because some patients with WM can develop acquired inhibitors due to IgM interference with clotting factors. So if that is additionally present, then that could be dealt with. That usually repairs itself once the treatment has been successful. So that's one thing I would think about. Obviously, we need to stage this patient, which will involve a bone marrow examination, including an aspirate fine flow cytometry. This is an apparently established diagnosis of WM. So this would be a confirmatory thing rather than a new diagnosis. But, you know, I think everyone would do the full works to check the situation. More than 90% of patients with Waldenstrom's have the MYD88L265P mutation, which is a somatic mutation, and that is regarded as the norm. So I would want to know whether that is the case, because if it isn't, then there could be other non-L265P mutations which can be looked for. Although the significance of how to manage those patients is open to debate. In real life, I would say, we regard people as MYD88 mutated, standard kind of approach to treatment. The other factor that comes to my mind is the other mutation that can happen, which is CXCR4. People with CXCR4 mutations, about a third of WM patients, do tend to have a higher disease burden, lower hemoglobin, perhaps bulky disease, and high paraprotein. So that's the thing about the genetics. Nowadays, I think it is pretty much widely done. We can talk a bit later about whether that influences treatment choice. So then, of course, once we confirm the situation, we deal with the immediate problems that the patient faces acutely. The plan then, we need to then move on to choice of therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as you say, that the utility of diagnostic genetics in choosing a line of therapy is perhaps a bit contentious. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps the things would have been easier 10 years ago when the only real choice in first relapse for women problems would have been further chemotherapy. How do you choose in this case between a sort of salvage and autograft strategy versus ibrutinib-based treatment?
Well, this is the key question, really. I mean, I think things were simpler, but also somewhat gloomier in the past when there was a limited number of therapies, and certainly BTK inhibitors have moved things along enormously, which is a great option to have for patients. And more are coming along beyond ibrutinib, which is great. I think, to my mind, however, you know, WM is a long-term disease in most people. So if this patient was 74 or 84, as long as they didn't have restrictions against a BTK inhibitor, I wouldn't hesitate to recommend that to them because they've had a decent round of first-line therapy and have not hung on to that response. I mean, it's been not too bad. But something like ibrutinib gives them the chance to have an oral therapy, which is continuous. We obviously just make sure that they don't have particular risk factors, cardiac problems, etc. In the most part, for the most part, people tolerate ibrutinib and such like very well. But in a younger patient, I'm a little more circumspect because we're talking about treatment that is daily and indefinite, as long as it works. And ibrutinib is still, and this class of drugs, are still young in terms of their track record. So ibrutinib, of course, has been around for a long time, particularly in CLL and so forth, mantle cell. But in WM, it's got a slightly shorter track record, numbers are smaller. And my own observation in my practice is that problems can accumulate with ibrutinib. And they can be challenging. They can lead to dose reductions. We don't quite know how long you might attain a response for. And that's why in a younger patient like this, I would consider whether she's better off going down the path of salvage therapy and even considering autologous transplant, because that might provide a deeper response. There's, you know, can be good clearance of disease in the marrow. And certainly our own experience and others has shown that you can get a long progression-free survival, which means the patient is free of treatment for however long. Now, no one knows exactly. Could be anywhere between 3 and 10 years. I mean, just this week, we saw a patient who's 20 years following his autologous transplant. So I definitely do not dismiss ASCT and WM. I think many colleagues find it a bit, they don't feel so sure about that because it's a low-grade disease and ASCT, of course, is potentially quite toxic. But again, if we prepare patients properly, if we look at their performance status, their baseline health, in my experience, it is very doable. And that reserves things like BTK inhibitors and so on for the future when we will have more data. And we will have, you know, we'll have perhaps probably be giving a combination. At the end of the day, then, we hopefully will get that patient into a, you know, we will, the therapy, the duration of remissions that add up hopefully will span decades. And we're not moving our way through therapies too quickly.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're saying that really the decision is based more on patient factors, their sort of age and fitness and comorbidities rather than disease biology, with our current ability to discern what that is.
Exactly. I think, I mean, obviously there are some theoretical and sort of published information about, you know, the variation of MYD88 or CXCR4 mutations and how those respond to BTK inhibitors and so on. The numbers are quite small. And I think that having seen a lot of WM over many years now, I know that there's more to it than that. There are sometimes patients have a sort of an aggressive phenotype, which doesn't necessarily come out in the numbers. But you know, someone who has had a very hyperviscous presentation, very cytopenic, etc. Yes, it's a low-grade disease, but that's a rather clinically aggressive presentation. And so yeah. I do take that into account when thinking about therapies. So, yeah, it's not binary is what I'm saying, I guess. Yeah. We do need to think about options in a careful, multi-dimensional way.
Thanks. So let's move on to our second case, which is a 78-year-old man. And he presented to his GP with discoloured fingers and areas of purpura and ulceration. He was anemic on his full blood count, which prompted the lab to make a film, which shows grey-blue extracellular aggregates. And following referral to haematology, he was found to have an IgM paraprotein of 4 grams per litre. I wonder if perhaps you could just walk us through the sort of laboratory testing for cryoglobulins. And perhaps, is it likely that this initial paraprotein result is an underestimate of his true level?
Yeah, so cryoglobulins creep up here, there, and everywhere in all our clinical practices, I think. I mean, there's type 1, 2, and 3. The ones that are more true to this clinical setting are the type 1s, which is monoclonal IgM based. The type 2s and 3s, the mixed ones, are often more in the arena of rheumatological diseases, although we do see some of those because WM and IgM diseases, monoclonal diseases, are rather immunogenic situations. So they do often coexist with rheumatological conditions and autoimmunity. So in effect, the first thing really is to consider the diagnosis, because the cryoglobulin test requires special consideration. Even if you think about it and tick the box, in my experience, that as well as the setting of cold agglutinin disease, there is a very high attrition rate for successful blood testing, because the sample has to be handled carefully from the moment it leaves the vein to the point it is delivered in the lab. It has to be kept at 37, or in fact 38 degrees. And the way we have overcome this in our hospital, because we have a geography of our hospital is spread over many blocks in London, is that we do have a warm centrifuge in our cancer center, because we see quite a lot of patients with IgM diseases. And so we take the samples and put that straight into the warm centrifuge and separate the plasma, the serum rather, and then that is sent to the laboratory. There, sometimes it's very obvious. It looks very gloopy and it's thick and hard to take out of the patient, etc. But sometimes it's not quite so straightforward. And actually, it's then put in the fridge for up to seven days to see whether it forms a little clot at the bottom. And then there is a process whereby they will seek out the nature of the cryoglobulin and also can measure a cryocrit to give us some quantitative measure. Now, none of these are, particularly free from pitfalls, and you do need an experienced biochemist who's kind of dedicated to the cause, because the worst thing in the world is to have a failed test and bring patients back, etc. Especially in the winter, because they then have to travel through the cold yet again. So testing for cryoglobulin is tricky, but is worth pursuing. There are many labs where there are still quite a lot of false positives or even false negatives, which can make things difficult. And the reason I will pursue this doggedly is in certain patients is when they do give a history of cold, sort of a cold disease history, where they often describe things like words to the effect that my body thermostat is up the creek. I feel very cold very easily. My legs feel like ice blocks. My hands, they get true acrocyanosis, in which clearly their hands and feet can change color, as indeed the nose, the ears, exposed areas. But they can also get circulatory disturbance, which can be very difficult, can cause pain. It can actually cause deadening of the nerves and inactivity while they're very cold. So they can get really, their quality of life and functionality can be really quite disturbed by it. So when people give that history, if I just get a negative cryo test one off, I will do it again generally, because I'm often convinced by the clinical picture. In terms of other manifestations, well, yes, I would look out for effectively hyperviscosity symptoms. Now, it's true to say that the presence of a cryoglobulin can really cause havoc with IgM readings, which is sort of a more of an in vitro phenomenon. So what happens is you can get initially a linear rise in an IgM, but suddenly it can really go off the scale. And quite often you just get excess of the highest limit on the IgM. And that again is a reason for me to think of cryoglobulin in these patients and then do the test. So yes, they often do have in vivo hyperviscosity because of the cryoglobulin. And that again brings out the possibility of plasma exchange as being a very useful therapeutic tool, especially in the short term when patients have acute effects. And the ones that are commonest in these patients are skin problems where they get ulceration, often in not even in acral sites, they can get them quite proximally. And just punched out lesions, which you get used to identifying as being rather characteristic of cryoglobulinemia. Clearly, that is a dangerous situation and requires quite brisk management with plasma exchange. And of course, treatment of the underlying clone, which depends a little bit on the scale of the problem. So when you stage the patient, if they have a heavy burden of Waldenstrom's, then you need to get around getting on with that. If they have a cryoglobulin in the setting more of an MGUS, then you can be a little, perhaps a bit lighter with the treatment because you don't need a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Unfortunately, however, sometimes IgM MGUSs with cryo can, the aggressiveness of the cryoglobulin can be very significant. And then you do have to upscale the treatment and be a bit more aggressive back. So yes, it is a specific problem that does need pretty quick management. Neuropathies can also result from cryoglobulinemias, usually have a vasculitic feel to them, as do the skin biopsies in that presence. And other things can happen like renal toxicity. In my experience, I don't see that much, to be honest, in the WM setting of renal problems and cryoglobulinemia. I think perhaps that happens more in the rheumatological setting. But yeah, something to be thought about, sought out, and not to be dissuaded from if it looks like that, and then to really focus in on treating the clone in a quite aggressive way. So this chap is 78. We need to look at his performance status. We need to see what comorbidities he has, because I would be inclined in general to go, if he's never had treatment, to go with chemo plus a rituximab, because I think the feeling of suppressing the clone is quite a strong one. And the other problem with rituximab and these IgM phenomena is that they can be flared by rituximab in the short term. And that's something to be avoided. And more so when they are hyperviscous, because then you can again push that off the scale. So a degree of cytoreduction is a good thing, I believe, along with plasma exchange. So in someone like him, I would favor something like bendamustine, but even cyclophosphamide, but I would perhaps use a judiciously lower dose in someone and go slowly with it so that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were.
Yeah. Do you need to start the chemotherapy before you give the rituximab, or is just giving them simultaneously sufficient?
Yeah. So I think if there's a hyperviscosity problem, the chemo should come first, because that will hopefully prevent the flare. If there isn't actually, because sometimes people are not particularly viscous, but they may have these manifestations, then I might use rituximab in a modulatory way, because that can help, especially if their performance status isn't great, because then you might be able to dampen down the process.
Yeah. And how long might you have to wait to get a response in terms of the cryoglobulin production? Might you be plasma exchanging for some months, or is it usually shorter than that?
Yeah, I mean, it can be so variable in my experience. I mean, some patients have a very stubborn cryoglobulin process, and it seems to just develop and have a life of its own. So you're busy trying to squash the clone and this, that, and the other, and it just seems to have developed a sort of internal cycling process. Interestingly, in the last couple of years, I have observed that COVID seems to flare up some of these immunological processes. And I know a couple of cryo patients have literally had COVID or the vaccines and have then had a flare of their cryoglobulin, triggering the need for plasma exchange and so on. So it can be quite variable. If you're lucky and you hit the nail on the head and you get the right clonal suppression and that's doing the trick, then you may only have to plasma exchange for a short period and then carry on with the chemo and the rituximab. But some patients you do have to press on for rather longer, and we definitely do that sometimes for months. Sometimes we time the exchanges to coincide with the winter period, because that's the patient tends to have a pattern that they have. And we then schedule them for plasma exchanges in the winter and then ease off in the summer and then sort of take it from there. Because it's a bit, you know, it goes up and down really.
And is the frequency usually guided by clinical manifestations or repeated measurements of their cryocrit or paracrit?
Yeah, I think primarily, I mean, most hospitals, honestly, getting these nice serial cryocrits is very difficult, including ours, where we see a lot of WM patients. But I think clinically is what I'd primarily go on. You know, what is the rate of change? How, you know, so for example, I mean, some of these manifestations are quite bedded in, like skin problems. So, you know, you can't sort of reverse ulceration in a week or two, but the patient will often report less pain, for example. They may have less fatigue. You may see a rise in hemoglobin because they often get anemic because of the whole inflammatory process. Yeah. So I primarily go on clinical response. And early on, I tend to be quite aggressive with the plasma exchanging. So I might even do it 3 times a week for 2 or 3 weeks if I'm particularly worried about the patient. Someone who's got a more slow burning process, I might just do it twice a week or weekly for a month. So it's very much an individualized thing. Yeah. And I've developed a feel in some ways, but I'm not aware of any kind of guidelines in this event, do this. You have to sort of suck it and see.
Yeah, okay, thanks. So let's move on to our third case, which was a 52-year-old man who presented with small volume lymphadenopathy and an IgM paraprotein at 7 grams per liter. And underwent a bone marrow biopsy and received a diagnosis of WM. 8 years later, he complained of dizziness and unsteadiness, with his wife reporting some memory problems. And his paraprotein had climbed ever so slightly to 9 grams per liter. Yeah, he underwent an initial CT head scan, which was unremarkable. So can you just tell us how you'd approach investigating this presentation?
Yes, indeed. So again, in this particular case scenario, it's a young chap and he's got an IgM related problem, which has been found to be WM, has not yet needed treatment. So that is the context. I have learned over the years that Bing-Neel syndrome is more common than we all think. So in our practice, we will anyone who has uncharacteristic or unexplained CNS symptoms, even if they're relatively vague, we would tend to have quite a low threshold for investigating the CNS. I mean, obviously we would exclude normal or usual things. We would look for evidence of stroke or metabolic problems, you know, if there's fevers and so on, looking for infective causes, all that sort of stuff. So the medical management is very, very important to make sure you know what's going on, or indeed intracerebral thrombosis, which perhaps is a greater risk in a patient with WM. So I'd want to know what his current status is in terms, you've mentioned his IgM is 9, so it's not particularly high, and his initial CT is unremarkable. So I would obviously stage the patient fully. I would also consider an MRI scan, to check whether there are more subtle signs of change in the white matter or indeed the meninges. I would ideally get a neurologist involved so that, you know, some formal evaluation can take place, both of the clinical examination, but as well, if he's beginning to have memory problems, I would actually advocate some cognitive function testing. I mean, again, this is a young patient, so I would be quite taking very seriously to look into this, because the good thing about Bing-Neel syndrome, it's very, you know, it's very treatable, very responsive to therapy. We'll come onto therapy in a minute because it's by no means established what the optimum therapy is, but we have seen patients who've developed rather severe dementia-like syndromes who have been bedbound and unable to sort of survive, you know, look after themselves, who have been treated successfully and have gone back to normal. I mean, it's often taken many months of treatments, but they have returned to self-functioning out of nursing homes back home. So I feel if there is suspected Bingneal, it's really worth looking for it, first with imaging and clinical examination and assessment. And then if you're not getting anywhere and you still feel that there is some compelling neurological problem going on, I would move on to a lumbar puncture, looking for raised protein, looking for cells using cytology, flow cytometry. I would send the CSF for MYD88 mutational analysis, bearing in mind that if you get a bloody tap, you may have contamination. So you do have to put all these things together. But I think the other thing about the nervous system is it generally, manifestations of neurological problems tend to be very anatomically true. So the difficulty with Bingneal is it just depends which bit of the brain it's affecting. And frankly, it can affect absolutely anywhere in the CNS. So you can get lumpy, bumpy bits, you can get leptomeningeal infiltration, you can get dural infiltration, you can get cells and floating around in the CSF, you can get all of the above or some of the above. And quite often there's edema. It's very important, of course, to exclude, especially in a fast-changing process, possibility of high-grade disease akin to primary CNS lymphoma. That clearly is a much worse prognosis. I would pursue that. We tend to do it in rather regulated fashion because we see quite a few patients in our service. Sometimes people actually have peripheral neuropathy symptoms as well. And that, the PNS and the CNS, we have a distinction, but actually biologically they're kind of connected. So, there may be infiltration and there may be inflammatory aspects. There may be even an add-on anti-MAG neuropathy just for good measure. So I think the key thing is to really remain quite protean in the assessment of these patients so that you assess them in a logical fashion. The biological mechanisms, I'd love to know more about them. We don't know why some patients have CNS tropic disease. I think there certainly is leakiness of the blood-brain barrier because quite often patients have very high CSF proteins. We often find IgM levels very raised in the protein in the CSF. So that would be good to know. If there is infiltration of the meninges, then you could think about that is a way of breaching and letting disease in. And I guess the final thing you'll ask about is management. Well, as I said, the first thing to remember is very treatable. Second thing to remember is that you do need something that penetrates the CSF. Rather the CNS. Some European colleagues quite keen on bendamustine in this setting because they have found that the people with BNS can respond to bendamustine. Our own experience, I think, partly because of our center where there's treatment of a lot of CNS lymphoma, I do advocate use of a sort of high-dose methotrexate and Ara-C type treatment, which is very much matched to the patient's performance status and well-being. Because if someone has a heavy burden of CNS disease, although ibrutinib crosses the blood-brain barrier, I'm not always sure that ibrutinib has got quite enough oomph in all cases. Our practice is often based on a sort of a modified matrix regimen, to be honest, where we give about 75% of Ara-C and methotrexate. Without the thiotepa, but the rituximab is in there. We then perhaps aim for a couple of cycles and then reassess the whole patient and then consider at that point, should we continue for more, which in some cases it seems important. In others, we might actually consolidate with ibrutinib because then that's a long-term treatment. So we're kind of charting out an algorithm, which we hope to review quite soon and try and submit, for publication. Just to try and bring a bit more clarity into this rare zone.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. Thank you very much for such a comprehensive survey through the various manifestations of WM. And you just touched on neuropathies. Yes. The whole extra world of complexity and interest there.
That's right.
Schedule that for a future date.
By all means.
So I'd like to thank Dr. Shirley Jassar from UCH. And Look forward to the next episode of the Lymphoma Podcast in a couple of months' time. Goodbye.
Thank you very much, Bernard. Thank you, BSH, as well. Bye-bye for now.